Hello everyone and welcome to A Cast of Kings, an unofficial podcast about the HBO original series Game of Thrones. My name is David Chen, and I've never read any of the books in George R.R. Martin's A Song of Ice and Fire.
My name is Joanna Robinson, and I have read every book in George R.R. Martin's A Song of Ice and Fire.
If you're just tuning in for the first time, you should know that we typically spoil everything through this week's episode of Game of Thrones, and that means that we'll have spoiled every single episode of Game of Thrones that's ever been released through Season 2, Episode 10, through the season finale of Season 2. And I'm not going to try to pronounce it, but Joanna, you want to give it a shot?
Valar Morghulis.
There you go. You can find all of our episodes at gameofthronespodcast.com, and you can email us at acastofkings@gmail.com. Let us know what you think of the show and of the podcast. So, Joanna, just so you know, since the last time we broadcast, I have actually moved again. I'm actually in a new place, so the sound might be a little bit different this week. It might be a little echoey, so deepest apologies for that, if it's annoying at all. But it's been a very tumultuous time in my life, Joanna. I don't know if you know this.
Well, you know what it sounds like to me, Dave? It sounds like spacious luxury. That's what I can hear in the podcast. The spacious luxury of your new place.
I think that is a good way to describe it. Anyway, let's get on with the show, Joanna. So we have a lot of thoughts about first of all, I just want to just a brief shout out to the deluge of emails that we got last week in support of the show. We're going to talk more about the future of the show, A Cast of Kings, at the end of the podcast. But I just wanted to say thank you to all those people who wrote into us at acastofkings@gmail.com. We read all of your messages, and they were greatly appreciated. So all that being said, Joanna Robinson, before we talk about the future of A Cast of Kings, let's talk about the future of some of these characters in Game of Thrones.
Ooh, nice.
Yeah, what did you think of this episode overall? Let's talk about overall, and then we'll go scene by scene as usual.
I have to say it was not my favorite. I feel like they tried to push too much to the end of the season. They sort of overreached themselves, I think, in this episode. There were a lot of individual moments that I liked, but as a whole, I was a little frustrated by it.
You know, I got to agree completely, Joanna. I think we're on totally the same page here, and I'm sure it distresses a lot of our listeners to hear that.
I know, I'm sorry.
But yeah, I mean, it was I thought the first half hour was incredibly strong. I thought it was just a great first half hour of television. And then the last half hour was just very, very frustrating and ultimately unsatisfying and disappointing, I thought. I mean, last week's episode was so amazing. I guess compared to last week, one could argue that any sort of finale would be a disappointment. But I would not make that argument, and I would dispute anyone who does. I will say I did listen to an interview that you suggested. The Empire podcast did a very nice interview with Neil Marshall, the film director who directed last week's episode, and it was pretty interesting to hear how that episode was put together. Two pieces of information I want to highlight about last week's episode, Blackwater. Number one is that like Neil Marshall came onto that episode 2 weeks before they actually shot it, so he like learned really fast, I guess. And the other
major kudos. I mean, that is so impressive. I know there were a lot of pieces in place, and he mentioned that too, how it was different from filming a film or filming a movie, I should say, in that, you know, the costumes and the props and everything was in place. So there was much less that, you know, that he had to do versus like as a filmmaker, but to put all that together, such an impressive, tight story with only 2 weeks' notice, you know, it was very, very great.
Yeah, very well done. So congratulations to Neil Marshall on, I think it's been described frequently as a near flawless hour of television. And I think you'll certainly find agreement with that sentiment on A Cast of Kings. But another thing that it also confirmed is that apparently the showrunners are just total perverts, right? Like that's the impression.
He mentioned that there was at least one perv producer who came up to him and said, like, you know, you can do full frontal. Yeah. In fact, I encourage, we want you to do full frontal.
Yeah.
You could just have her be naked and that's fine. I speak for and he said, like, I speak for the perverts in the audience, you know, just assuring him that they wanted this in the show, which is a theory we've all had. And yeah, Neil Marshall confirmed it.
It's not shocking or surprising, but
no.
It is shocking and surprising to hear it confirmed. Put it that way.
Right.
So that's It was. I'm not gonna lie. It was a little bit distressing to hear that. But it's,
well, for everyone who thinks that the nudity was just an organic part of the storyline, I have to say, double ha for that. Because yes. No, having a naked woman on someone's lap, on Bronn's lap, randomly last episode. I mean, it wasn't the end of the world, but it didn't add anything to the story. It's just there for titillation, which, you know, just as long as you know that that's why.
Yeah, as long as you know what you are, listener. You know, as long as you know it, then it's fine. We don't mind as long as you know what you are. You know, that's fine. Then enjoy away. But just don't convince yourself that it's high art. I think is the point we're trying to make here. So,
and Neil Marshall as well, I guess.
Yes, indeed. All right. Anyway.
So yeah, that was the Empire podcast, and it's about a 20 minute interview with Neil Marshall. It's really good.
Yeah, pretty good. Check it out if you have a chance. So, you guys have our overall thoughts on this week's episode. Let's get to the specifics of this week's episode. This week, we open the episode to find out that Tyrion is not dead. So that's good.
Yay!
Everyone's happy, and he's just brutally maimed and disfigured from it. But he is certainly still alive, and Maester Pycelle gets to have his last laugh. And Jonah Robinson... In my opinion, Tyrion Lannister has become the Jack Bauer of Game of Thrones. In the sense that he gave everything for his country and was not rewarded with a ticker tape parade, but with the disdain of those that are far less talented than he is.
I mean, that is the biggest injustice, I think, of the entire book and the entire season, is Tyrion spends so much of the season being such a badass and doing everything for King's Landing. I mean, for the people of King's Landing, and they shun him and they look down on him, and then he gets none of the credit.
Yeah.
So it's a huge injustice. And I wanted to ask you, Dave, did you hear anything about the way in which that character is injured in the book?
No. Oh, the way Tyrion is injured?
Yeah.
No, I did not.
They slice his nose clean off in the book.
Oof.
And I was pretty sure they were not going to do that to Dinklage. And I was pretty sure they were going to have to green screen his nose out for the rest of the series. But he should be thankful that he just has that scar on his face and didn't lose his nose. So. Yes.
And we also find out no love lost between Cersei and Tyrion. Cersei was the one that ordered Tyrion to be killed last week.
Yes.
So thank goodness Podrick was able to save him, but... that is when you know that your relationship is on the rocks, is when your sister orders your death on the battlefield. And so...
It's a good indicator, yeah.
So, theoretically, they're like, okay, you got to get out of here or else you're going to die because, like, you're not even the hand of the king. You don't even have that arbitrary protection anymore. And what of Bronn, Joanna? What of Bronn? Do we know what happens to him? I don't think we see him in this episode, right?
You don't know what happens to him, no.
I don't know what happens to him. I'm worried about him, because that guy was a badass. So, anyway, very disappointing to see. And then he has this nice scene with Shay.
And, you know, this was my favorite scene of the whole episode.
Yeah, and we kind of talked last week about, like, whether this whole thing was convincing or not. And I actually thought it was just right. This is why I thought this episode started off so strong. This storyline and the Theon storyline, I thought were both excellent.
I want to go with you.
So do it. Your father, your sister, all these bad people, they can't stop you. Forget about them. Come with me.
I can't. I do belong here. These bad people, what I'm good at, out talking them, out thinking them, it's what I am. And I like it. I like it more than anything I've ever done. Are you going to leave?
You have a shit memory. I am yours, and you are mine.
We've talked in the past about kind of, do you buy that there's actually affection there? And I always bought it, but I also understand, right, why Tyrion, who's used to sleeping with different whores all the time, did not necessarily believe that there was. And now he finds out that there is, And this kind of relief and the joy and just kind of...
Yeah, Dinklage's face, yeah. Its face just sort of crumpled, and it was just... I thought that was the strongest moment of the whole entire episode. And it's interesting that they started with it. I mean, narratively, I guess you wanted to know right away whether or not Tyrion was alive. But since Dinklage has been like the strongest actor on the show and, you know, everyone's favorite, a fan favorite, why they wouldn't save him to the end, you know? Like, would lead that with that, you know? Well, anyway, we'll get to the rest of the episode,
yeah.
I guess.
No, I agree. I agree. Like, that's something you kind of want to build up to, not necessarily come down from. So,
right.
Anyway, so that was great. That was really good. And Tyrion's like, oh, I want to stay here. I don't know how he's going to carve out a life for himself in King's Landing, given that tons of people, or at least his sister, who's now in a very high position of power, wants to kill him. Compared to him, I mean, she's in a high position of power. I don't know how he's going to make his way through there, but that's what he loves to do. You know, it's what he loves to do. So
yeah, and that's what we've been seeing all season is Tyrion just on top of his, on top of his game, just beating everyone at a battle of wits all season. So of course, like, how could he leave that? It's what he loves to do best. It's the tallest, you know, no pun intended, kind of pun intended. It's the tallest he's ever felt in his life, you know, towering mentally over all these people. And it's too good for him to leave. And
yeah, and I think the show does a really good job of conveying that he's pretty solid at this. So
yeah.
I bought all that. That was good. Good stuff.
Yeah.
And then we flash, or not flash forward, but we just kind of cut to a horse taking a dump. And then,
right.
You know, Tywin enters the throne. What did you make of the horse taking a dump? Why do you think the show showed us that? Is that in the book? Is a dump in the book?
The dump is not in the book, to my knowledge.
Okay. Oh my gosh, now we're going to get like 50, you know, emails about how the dump was in the book.
Yeah, I can't wait for all the passages, the quotes
from the book.
Remember on page 357, Joanna, where he describes the steam wafting off the dump? No, I didn't remember that. I think that's a pretty heavy-handed metaphor, is it not? I think that's what the dump is there for. I loved the dump.
Okay. Well, I mean, let's just make clear what it is, right? I mean, my thinking is that it's very regal and courtly for him to kind of stroll into this courtroom, but behind all of that, literally behind all of that, it's actually just a real filthy animal. You know what I mean? That is still, you know, just an animal. There is kind of this underside to this veneer of royalty.
Right, the seedy underbelly and horseshit of courtly life. How everything you hear, and you know, Littlefinger brings it up at the end, how everything you hear in the ensuing scene is one big pretense of everyone has their lines that they say, and everyone, you know, there's nothing real going on in this entire scene.
Right, yeah. So, you know.
You know, Joffrey's protestations, you know, like, so...
So, yeah. So something about this episode that I thought was pretty interesting was that you have, on a number of occasions, people trying to kind of keep their word, you know, and struggling with keeping their word. And in this instance, you have Joffrey kind of being like, no, I must marry Sansa, blah, blah, blah. And you're saying that that's all BS? Like, he doesn't actually think that? Like,
that's my interpretation, is that it was a staged thing set up between Cersei and, you know, the... is it a Grandmeister? I don't know. No, High Septon, probably. This whole dialogue about, oh, no, I can't marry Margaery. I am too honor-bound. The gods would disapprove. And they're like, no, my lord. It is fine. You know, it's to dispel any, you know, if he was too eager to marry Margaery and dump Sansa, people would be like, well, that was pretty disloyal. But now they can say, oh, our king was so loyal to Sansa, but his advisors told him not to. You know, I think Joffrey...
I see. So you thought it was all staged.
Yeah, I did.
Interesting. I thought it was... the way I interpret it was like it was one redeeming thing about Joffrey is that he at least tries to keep his word and actually perhaps genuinely has fear of the gods. Perhaps. That was actually my interpretation.
I think his soul is just black through and through.
That's fair enough. But yeah, I mean, because we see... I believe we see later on in this episode people like trying to keep their word and failing at doing it, but... anyway, he becomes betrothed to Margaery in this case. And, you know, this is something I wanted to bring up a while ago, but I never had a chance to bring up, which is that one question I have, and you may know the answer to this question, and if you do, don't, you know, if it's from a future book, don't answer me. But can Joffrey actually have sex normally? Do you know? Because he doesn't seem to experience any pleasure unless it's through torturing or killing people. And then there's that scene when, like, you know, he had the two prostitutes and they, like, kind of, like, grabbed at his, like, crotch, and he like recoiled from it. He was like, "Whoa, let's not do that." As though he reminded me of, I want to say, if you watch The Sopranos, I think it was Ralph Cifaretto in that show who, like, couldn't have sex normally. He could only get off by doing really bizarre behaviors. So I don't know if you have a take on that, Joanna, or if it's answered in the book anywhere, but.
I think based on what we've seen in the show, it's not an unreasonable interpretation, yeah. But I have no other comment on it.
Okay. Fair enough. So yeah, my thing is, like, Marjorie was unable to, the reason I bring it up, it's not just, Joanna, this is not just idle speculation. Okay. This is obviously very crucial to the future of the series is, I don't just spend my time thinking about Joffrey's sex life on my own free time. You know what
oh,
I mean?
Oh, sure. Of course. Yeah.
No. Marjorie was unable to consummate her marriage, and that's a key plot point in this episode. It's why she's right. able to be promised to Joffrey.
She's still a virgin.
Exactly. So can Joffrey consummate the marriage is my question. And so far, I don't think we've seen any evidence that he can. So
what I'll say is I agree with you in that we have not seen any glimmer of a sexual appetite from Joffrey, only a sadistic pleasure in torturing things.
Right.
I would agree with that. So
it remains to be seen whether or not that's going to happen. And then Littlefinger, so Sansa's like, "Oh, well, I'm free." No. I don't even know. She's so smart, I was surprised that she even thought that she was free. But anyway, Littlefinger makes her an offer. She's like, "Hey, I'll bring you back home." I don't know what type of game he's playing. But yeah, I mean, any thoughts on this, Joanna?
Yeah, well, I agree with you. Sansa has been pretty smart, but you know, what I will admire about her is that she continues to play the game, even with Littlefinger, even if he tells her she's playing it crappily, but she's like, "Oh, they're so right. I wasn't good enough for him. And oh no, King's Landing is still my home." You know, she's still playing the game and trying to save herself. So to a certain extent, she has still got her wits about her, but there is that relief of, I do not have to be the queen. And then, yeah, she didn't think about the torturing and the potential raping, you know.
Yeah.
So,
although based on what we just said, maybe none of that's a problem or none of that's going to be a problem.
Probably.
But in any case, Littlefinger makes her this offer to kind of help her escape and stuff. And it remains to be seen whether or not she accepts it and makes good on it. She apparently did not accept the Hound's offer last week to get taken away, and I think she's probably regretting that decision right about now.
Yeah, it would be nice to be gone from King's Landing right about now.
Yeah. We also, so that's kind of what happened at King's Landing. We also learned not what happened, not the sort of ultimate resolution of Theon's storyline, but we learn a little bit more, and I just love these scenes between Theon and Maester Luwin back at Winterfell. Very moving stuff. And you know that when he's talking about who he's pretending to be, and you know, like, you've seen Theon for two seasons, you know that he's not ultimately a monster at heart. But sometimes, right, in our lives, Joanna, we make decisions and get so far down a hole that we don't even remember what life was like when we weren't in the hole.
Once a man has taken the black, is beyond reach of the law. All his past crimes are forgiven.
I won't make it to the wall. I won't make it 10 feet past the Winterfell gates.
There are ways. Hidden passageways built so the lords of Winterfell could escape. The road will be dangerous. But with a little luck, the Night's Watch is an ancient, honorable order. You'll have opportunities there.
The opportunity for Jon Snow to cut my throat in my sleep.
the opportunity to make amends for what you've done.
I've done a lot, haven't I? Things I never imagined myself doing.
I've known you many years, Theon Greyjoy. You're not the man you're pretending to be. Not yet.
You may be right. I've gone too far to pretend to be anything else.
Yeah, I would agree. I think Alfie Allen as Theon Greyjoy this season has been amazing, and I think he was the second strongest character in this episode. You know, after Tyrion, Theon's storyline in this episode, there was so much more than what you see in the book, and I loved it. I loved all the extra monologuing that they gave to him. I loved his speech. I thought Alfie Allen really sold all of it. But
what was awesome about that speech was just that it's the one moment in the whole season when you're like, well, here's Theon finally redeeming himself, and it's then totally undercut by the fact that they completely knock him out unconscious afterwards.
Yeah. And that whole setup is a weird departure from the book that I can only imagine they did because of budgetary reasons. The reason the Battle of Blackwater was so amazing because they didn't show the sacking of Winterfell at all, you know? And so instead we get a weird inside job from his first mate and stuff like that. And that's, I mean, that's fine. The bottom line is the story was still the same, is that Theon is finally brought down.
Well, hold, I mean, we don't really know what happens, Joanna, to Winterfell.
No, I know. I know you don't know what's happened, but he's brought down by his own men, you know?
Right, that's true.
He's dragged off screen. That's the last thing you saw, right?
Yeah, and it's unclear. There's a lot of people who are like unclear what the hell is going on. Like,
oh, exactly. I know. The show did not make it clear what happened at Winterfell.
Yeah, like
whether intentionally or not, and I will not spoil what happened.
What happened to the men? How did they get out of there? Did they like broker some deal, you know, with the, like, my thought was that they brokered some deal with the Stark clan that they would give over Theon in exchange for their release. Or they're going to use the tunnels. It's not clear to me what's going on.
Yeah, I agree. It was kind of vague, and you don't know who burned Winterfell, so you know, or why.
Right. Oh yeah. So when you see Bran sort of escaping with Hodor and Osha afterwards to see Master Luwin, that's when you see Winterfell burning in the background. Or they get there and it's like totally destroyed. Right.
Well, they were there the whole time. They were down in the crypts underneath, and they come up, and everything is burnt to the ground, and there's no one left. And Theon had that speech. For those of us who knew what was going to happen to Winterfell, Theon's speech earlier in the episode where he says, you know, first time I saw Winterfell, it seemed like a building that had always been there and would always be there. And there are a bunch of us watching going, I don't think it's going to make it through this episode, but okay. And sure enough, yeah, it's this huge location in the show. And it's, you know, in those cool opening credits, that Winterfell little mechanic tree thing that blossoms at the beginning. Are we going to see that at all next season? Probably not, because Winterfell is ash. Ash now.
Yeah, kind of a bummer. And I brought up Asha. That was the other thing that the other person, like, who is keeping her commitments, I think, in a really admirable way.
Yeah.
Because if you recall, right, Asha was, you know, she had no loyalty to the Stark clan other than the fact that they did not kill her when they had the chance. What is her loyalty? You know, like, why does she have loyalty to Bran? You know, there's no real reason other than that she's at heart a good person, because she could just like leave, you know what I mean? Like there's no, in my opinion, the show has not presented a compelling reason for her to kind of want to help the Starks out, other than that there's goodness in her, or maybe she's really serious about keeping her word, you know what I mean? Because like there's no sort of like societal structures in place to make her stay.
Yeah, I think maybe the show isn't doing a very good job, but I think there's some genuine affection there.
Yes.
You know, the way she calls them the little lords, Bran and Rickon and stuff like that, I think she just has some genuine affection for the kids. And also in this episode, she mentions, you know, Maester Luwin says, you'll have to defend them against your own people. And she says, you know, I'm no fan of my own people. You know, so I think she didn't have anyone she was really betraying by staying with the Starks, because she had no real affection for the wildlings where she came from. So.
Right.
And Maester Luwin, I mean, if you want to talk about oath keeping, Maester Luwin in that scene with Theon, he says, I serve Winterfell, and I believe him. You know, the maesters are supposed to serve where they are, no matter who's in charge. And so he says, I serve Winterfell. And when he advises Theon to flee, like, you know, he's giving him good advice.
Yeah.
And he has his, you know, despite all the things he's seen Theon do, he's trying to protect him, and he's trying to stay true to his oath. So that was really touching oath keeping as well.
Which, I mean, Theon does not follow that advice ultimately.
No. Right? No.
And, you know, not following Winterfell people's advice is really what got him into this mess. So. Yeah. And yet he continued to not do it. And that's the ultimate tragedy of Theon, is that his own actions, his own attitude led to his own undoing. I mean, some people have compared him to Walter White from Breaking Bad, I think, is that it's his pride that has kind of destroyed him, and really a tragic figure. And, I was a little bit unsatisfied that we knew nothing. In a normal show, right? In a normal show that's not Game of Thrones, when you get to a cliffhanger, it's just one cliffhanger. Do you know what I'm saying? Like, it's like, oh my gosh, is this person alive or dead? Right?
Right.
Like, or, oh my gosh, like, are they going to solve the crime? Or, you know, like, it's one cliffhanger. And the thing that I think is kind of frustrating about Game of Thrones in some ways is that it's like, it's not one cliffhanger, it's four cliffhangers.
Seven. Yeah, exactly.
Some plot lines I think are resolved really well. And you know, for instance, let's go to the Dany storyline. Right?
Okay.
Like, that totally badass. The way she and there's this very haunting series of scenes where she kind of sees Khal Drogo, she sees the throne room, like, all, you know, covered in snow and stuff, and she goes out. It looked like north of the wall is where she was.
Right, right.
Very evocative, beautiful stuff. At the same time as I'm, like, appreciating how beautiful this is, I'm also frustrated that we're not resolving other storylines in a more satisfying way. Not that it would be possible, but
this is the argument I was making last week, is like, how cool would it have been if Dany's storyline had been compressed? And instead of four episodes of her whining around Carth about her dragons, you had seen the House of the, you know, you had seen the House of the Undying stuff, which is so cool. And they did it very differently in the book. It's a fever dream, and there are a bunch of visions, and you don't see anything that makes really any sense to you, but it's very well described. I think it's much smarter television to show us Khal Drogo and things we recognize, and make it sort of like a Persephone myth where they're trying to sort of seduce her into staying underground, and you know, she has to get out and leave the things that are attractive to her. But you know, it would have been so much stronger if it had been a bit more compressed. I think the Dany stuff was just so drawn out this season, and as cool as this was, it doesn't make up for all that stuff that was just waiting around and place setting and that sort of stuff. And instead, I feel like this episode would have been so much more powerful if we had only had four storylines to resolve and had paid a lot more attention to them. Does that make sense? Rather than let's see this character, let's see this character, let's see this character, let's see this character, see you next season. You know?
And, well, I think Dany's is one of the more satisfying resolutions. It's like, hey, okay, we got the dragons back, but at least, you know, like next season is when we're going to get our ships. And like, okay, that is a solid way to end a sort of season for a character is, you know, they had a plot, it got resolved, and then, you know, there's some future promise of something else happening later on.
Right.
And I don't think that's how a lot of the plot lines ended, in my opinion. And we'll get to those very shortly. Before we move off of Dany, though, so we found out that what's his name? Zorro,
yeah.
He was like the emperor with no clothes, right? He had no money in his vault.
Right.
And I love how, like, there's this moment when they open the vault door and there's nothing inside, and then Dany just nods to her people, and they put Zorro and her, like, betrayer helper woman inside the vault, and like it's total silence. It's the Game of Thrones equivalent of guys walking away from explosions without looking at it. It's like, what did they like negotiate that beforehand? She's like, okay, look, guys, we're gonna open the vault, and if there's nothing inside, I want you to just put them inside. You know what I mean? Like, it's just, I'm being silly.
No, of course. It was a plan with contingencies.
Exactly.
I liked how over that scene, and I think the rest of the Dany Jorah moments in that segment, they played the Game of Thrones theme song really slowly, and it was a pretty epic moment, I think. And I liked how Zara was saying, you know, I'm the king of Karth. I can help you. And it reminded me so much of last season and her brother Viserys being like, I'm a king. And it's like, dude, you know when you're beat, know when you're down, and some humility would be helpful, you know?
Right. Just for the dignity of it.
Yeah, you know, exactly.
You're already dead to rights. You might as well die with dignity.
That was pretty cold though, putting your handmaiden in the vault.
Well, what
it's pretty icy.
So that's my question. Is like, what was going on with that? Like, why did she believe that her handmaiden had betrayed her? What did her handmaiden do that was wrong, other than sleep with Zaro, which I agree is a heinous crime?
I think that's it. Just sleeping with Zaro.
Is that it? I mean, just
sleeping with Zaro, who had betrayed her.
So sleeping. I got you.
Zara, who conspired to steal her babies, her dragons.
Right. And we should say, I thought, you know, they used up a ton of their, I'm sure, remaining budget getting the dragons in there. And the way that Pyat Pri was dispatched was pretty satisfying. It's always satisfying. I mean, anytime you want to have a satisfying scene, have a woman be subjected to some kind of punishment or torture, and then, you know, have her get back at her attacker / perpetrator. And this scene did that in a really accelerated fashion.
Yeah.
It was literally like moments after she was chained up forever. You're just beginning to contemplate the enormity of what has befallen her, and she's already freed herself.
What do you think? Why do you think Pyat Pri wanted her there? Like, I'm a little confused. Like, was he going to draw power?
Yeah,
that
was
having
my, that was
her
my
and the dragons. Okay.
He's like, she's like Rogue in X-Men 1.
Okay.
You know? She harnesses strengthens the power of the dragons, and then by extension, the dragons being more powerful strengthens Pyat Pri.
And then to further the X-Men metaphor, what did you call him before? Multiple Man? Is that what it is?
Multiple Man, yeah.
That Multiple Man can be like 100 times more multiple than he has already been.
But apparently Multiple Man can't teleport himself out of being on fire. So that's kind of a bummer for Pyat Pri, but whatever.
Bummer.
Whatever. I mean, you know, let's ignore the fact that Pyat Pri could have, you know, teleported himself into water or whatever. You know, I'm just going to ignore that for now. Because, you know, whatever. It's not like there's rules in this universe or anything.
But at the end of the day, though, Jorah gets what he wants, which is he's going to get her one ship, or that's the plan. So they're going to get one ship, and that's what he wanted all along for her. So
yes, so Jorah is the winner of unquestionably the winner of this episode, second maybe to Tyrion. So
and I was glad to see a lot of her Khalasar was still alive, because I thought they had all been.
Yeah, what's going on? Those guys just appeared out of nowhere.
I thought she had one left.
She had the one guy.
She had 15, and I was like, oh, okay.
Yeah, all right, okay. So she decided to go to the House of Undying with one.
Yeah.
Leave the other 15 guys just back
at home.
They were napping.
Or they were planning the whole vault maneuver.
Yeah,
they're strategizing. Vault's empty, we push her in. You got it, guys?
Yeah. Right. If it's empty, then we're burying them alive in there. And if it's not empty, then we're slitting their throats. I think that's what the plan was.
Exactly.
We should also mention that, actually, Joanna, we didn't mention this in the notes, but we should also mention what happened to Stannis.
Yeah, Stannis and Melisandre.
Now let me just say something about last week's episode. My perception of last week's episode was that Stannis had been captured.
I agree. A lot of people had that, were confused by that. That was one of the flaws in Neil Marshall's brilliant Blackwater episode, is that it ended and you thought that Stannis was being held back by Lannister men. But it was his own men who were like, let's get out of here while we still can. And he's like, no, my throne, like that. So,
and to be clear, it was Neil Marshall who came up with the idea to put Stannis on the castle walls. Like right. In the original draft of the script, Stannis was just kind of chilling out, you know, with his troops. And so that's probably where the confusion originated from.
Possibly, yeah. I think there's just something they could have done, maybe distinguished the Baratheon men, the Stannis Baratheon man from the Lannister men in some costume or otherwise, so that you wouldn't be – I think everyone I talked to thought that Stannis had been – who hadn't read the books thought that Stannis had been captured by the Lannisters. So
Stannis gets really pissed off, starts to choke Melisandre. And again, my question is, like, where is the smoke baby who was introduced – you know, like –
Release the smoke baby, Melisandre.
I literally expected like Stannis' chest to burst open with a freaking blade from the smoke baby. I'm not joking at all. Like, I seriously thought that would happen, because why would Melisandre allow that to happen? You know what I mean? Like, why would she allow herself to be choked in that way? I guess you could argue that because the prophecy demands it. But, you know, It was a
really weird scene. I don't really fully understand the scene, though I will say that it was some of my favorite acting from Stephen Delane, who we talked last week about being how Stannis has been sort of an inaccessible character this season. And I think that scene was the most human we've seen him in his grief and frustration. I mean, yeah, he was choking his sorceress, so maybe that's not super sympathetic, but his despair over losing the end game, you know? I thought, you know, didn't that seem to be like the most human we've seen? You know, he wasn't correcting anyone on their grammar. He wasn't, you know.
He wasn't celebrating how many people would die. No, I agree with you completely. I think it was really – it did really humanize him. So,
but it was a weird scene. It was very weird to me.
Yeah. It was pretty – okay. And then he's like – she's like, look in the flames. Do you see the future? And he's looking in the flames, and it's not clear to me whether he's seeing the future or if he's being hypnotized. And I think that ambiguity is supposed to be there. I don't know if you had a take on that.
Yeah. I think it was ambiguous.
Yeah.
It was the second – I'd have to rewatch the episode. I don't know if they actually did it with multiple characters, but it was the second eyeball shot we got. You know, we got Tyrion's eyeball, and then we got Stannis' eyeball.
Yeah.
So I don't know if they did that with a bunch of characters. It was a very lost – the television show Lost sort of shot.
Yeah. So, okay. So – and then we get to Arya's storyline in this episode as well. And we're way out of – we're jumping around at this point. So
yeah, sorry, guys.
Sorry about that. But I mean, in my opinion, like Arya and to some extent like Dany's storylines really exemplify like what went wrong this season. Because like Arya has basically – okay. So she started the season wandering aimlessly with Gendry and ended it basically exactly the same way. And it's just like, what has been accomplished here? Almost nothing.
Here's where I'll vent my frustration about the way they botched the Harrenhal escape. Because what I think narratively is accomplished by the way the Harrenhal escape is done in the book is you see her, she actually has to participate more. And she kills a couple people. And I think that's kind of big for the character. You know, she killed someone accidentally, at the end of last season, but this is, you know, she has to kill some people in order to survive. And I think it's huge for her character. And the way they did it, for whatever reason, I don't know why, but the way they did it, maybe because they didn't want to show a kid killing other kids or killing people on TV, much like the Hunger Games shied away from kids killing kids violence. You know, I don't know what it was.
But they actually did show it in Hunger Games, though. Like, they did show kids killing other kids. It wasn't very graphic. But
with shaky cam so that you couldn't tell what was going on.
Right. Well, no. There was one scene that was pretty rough in that movie. But yeah, I mean, they did show it.
And yeah. So does that answer your question? Like, I feel like narratively in the books, it's an important journey for Arya because, yes, she ends up exactly the same as she starts. She's got Gendry and she's got Hot Pie and she's wandering around. There is no adult to look after her. There was an adult. Yoren was looking after her at the beginning of this season, in the beginning of the book. There's no adult looking after her. It's just she's the definite leader of the three at the end of the story. But she's had that it's a huge change for her life to have gone through that. And she also gets much more humiliated at Harrenhal. She's worked and spit upon and just sort of brought so low when she's at Harrenhal, as opposed to in this season when she's sort of treated very, you know, with kid gloves by Tywin, basically. And so I think her character is hugely different, and I agree with you in that you don't see any of that in the way they've done it in the show. I think Jaqen H'ghar was a great character, and I think they did okay with him, but I think they did Arya a disservice by the way they did the escape from Harrenhal.
Yeah, and I mean, I think at the beginning of this season, I asked you, what are you most looking forward to? And you said Arya's storyline, and it's ended up being the lamest storyline, in my opinion. And
I mean, other than the really great scenes between her and Tywin, which were great just because the actors did a fantastic job.
Yeah, exactly. But it's like, what has that accomplished? Like, she didn't even, it's not like she used that, it's not like she used her position as, like, you know, one would think when you're setting something like that up, she's going to use her position to give her brother the advantage somehow. But they didn't even do that. You know, it seemed like it accomplished nothing at all. Right. And it's just, it's super lame. And I think, I'm just like, what is the point of this when I'm watching it? I'm being very uncharitable right now. I mean, I love those scenes between Tywin and her, but it's just like, where is this going? And right. I don't think I'm unreasonable to ask that. So,
right.
And apparently, Jaqen H'ghar is a shapeshifter now. So that's a thing, right?
Yes.
I don't know.
He's a faceless man.
So, I was reading Miles McNutt's review of it, and apparently it's supposed to be conveyed that she is giving up something huge by not going with Jaqen H'ghar. Is that correct? And if so, was that supposed to be conveyed to me? Because it wasn't that clear to me that she's giving up that much by not going with him.
Well, it's weird. It's kind of like it's an amazing opportunity, and maybe you don't get, maybe you haven't gotten as much from the show how cool Jaqen H'ghar is and how fancy his powers are. Basically, you don't really get that from the season. They took a lot of the magic out of what he did. So his you know, one of the murders in the books, it's like he gets the dog, like some guy's dog, to just turn on him. So he's got magic. These aren't physical assassinations so much as they are magical assassinations. So when he offers to train Arya, it's this huge honor, and you know, he sees something in her and he wants to train her, and she says no. And so in that sense, yeah, I think it's bigger than what is shown. But it's interesting, isn't it? You know, like Sansa turns down the Hound and Arya turns down Jaqen H'ghar, and they're sort of determined, these Stark girls, to sort of do it for themselves, do it on their own, you know?
Yeah, yeah, I agree.
Interesting.
It is interesting. And I mean, going into the season, I agreed with you. Like, I was like, Arya, wow, this is like one of my favorite characters. And you know, they're taking it slow this season, and who knows? Maybe like season three with Arya is going to be like absolutely incredible what they do with her. I don't know, but I can say that this season was kind of a disappointment from that character's perspective.
Yeah.
But that's understandable, Joanna, because in exchange for a really satisfying plotline with Arya, we got to have a really lovely love story between Rob and Talisa. And I mean, I was just demanding more Rob Talisa scenes, because really, you know, it's like when they're on another scene like Brienne or Dany or whatever, I'm just like, more Rob and Talisa, please, because that is the most unique and interesting storyline out of all of these. We've never seen a Rob Talisa storyline like this before, like ever in movie history. You know what I mean? Like, no storyline has ever transpired in this way before, and so thank God they spent so much time on it this episode, because otherwise we would have deprived us of a truly unique take on a star-crossed lover's love story, you know?
I think we're all drowning in your sarcasm now.
I think you should be. I mean, okay, yay, they got married. Who cares? You care? I don't care.
I'm really pissed, actually. I thought they were going to save – okay, I thought they were going to save the whole announcement of Brandon Rickon's death until the season finale, and so it was going to be this big, like, you know, Brandon Rickon's supposed death.
Right.
So that Kat and Rob find out and are like, oh no, Brandon Rickon, that's so sad. But they didn't even do it this episode. So I don't know why they were saving it and why they didn't do it earlier. Because, as I said before in a previous podcast, that explains why Rob is such a dumbass and marries Talisa, or her equivalent in the book, and why Catelyn is such a dumbass and releases Jamie. Like, that is their motivation. They are grief-stricken and not acting with, you know, their full mental capacities. And they bond over that. They both do stupid things, and then they come together and they were like, that was pretty stupid what you did. And he's like, that was pretty stupid what you did. And they're like, well, we're pretty sad because Bran and Rickon are dead. Oh, well, let's be friends again, you know? And this way you just have people acting kind of recklessly and stupidly and at each other's throats. You've got Kat and Rob sort of sniping at each other. And, you know, I don't get it. I mean, I know a lot of our listeners have said, are tired of me saying, oh, it's better in the book or whatever. But when you sacrifice character, and I don't know why, like if you do it for budgetary reasons, okay. But when I don't know why, then I have a problem with it.
Yeah, well...
Who knows? Obviously.
Clearly, but John, I think you're really underselling how innovative this Rob Talisa storyline is. I think is what the issue here. That's what the disconnect is. You know what I mean?
Oh, right.
I'm totally being sarcastic.
It's, I know.
I have no desire to see these characters on screen. I just do not. It is the least interesting storyline out of all of them. Right, because we've seen that love story a gajillion times. We haven't seen freaking dragons freeing a chained up woman, you know, by setting on fire a teleporting man before, okay? So that's all I'm saying, is like, why even focus on that at all?
Let's go to a better storyline.
We got to see Brienne and Jamie have more, and it's just so charming.
It was.
Them interact. It's so hilarious. And then when those three guys come down the street, I'm like, oh my gosh, are we finally going to get a chance to see Brienne be a total badass? And at first I thought, oh, maybe they're going to get free. But then, you know, the freaking Stark man or whatever was so smart. He came up with a really ingenious plan. He's like, okay, say what his name is on the count of three. I mean, you gotta admit, that's pretty clever, right?
That was pretty good.
That's kind of like, okay, I have like a fox and a hen and a sack of corn. I'm trying to get across the river. How do you take them across? You know what I mean? It's kind of like, ooh, you thought that up all by yourself. That's pretty impressive. So
there are two guards. One can only tell the truth and one only tells lies.
Yes, exactly. And so yeah, it was like on that caliber. And then you see her, you know. So wait. So what was unclear to me was like, who were these women that were hanged up there?
So, there were signs on them or something like that, that Jamie reads out that says they slept with lions or something like that. So Jamie's interpretation was that these were women, tavern wenches or whatever, who had slept with or made out with or showed some favor towards Lannister men. And because they had shown some favor towards Lannister men, they were raped and killed. And so it's a kind of interesting muddying of the moral waters, because we've been seeing the Northmen, the Stark men, and the Northmen as the good guys and the Lannisters as the bad guys. But so then Jaime is taunting Brienne and saying like, oh, you must be so proud to serve the Starks. Look at the way the Starks have treated these women, you know, blah, blah, blah. And Brienne says, no, I don't serve the Starks. I serve Lady Catelyn. That's it. I don't serve the Starks. And so, you know, it was a nice, you know, muddying of the moral waters and seeing like everyone can be a bastard on both sides. You don't have, it's not black and white. And I love the dynamics between Bran and Jamie. I thought it was a great scene, and I love how quickly he like caught on and played the part of the pig thief or whatever it was, trying to get out of it. And
well, it is interesting to me, like Jamie's character is kind of interesting, like what his game is. Again, I brought this up in the past. He's always taunting his captors as if he wants to be killed, but ultimately he does have a self-preservation instinct, right?
Right, yeah.
Like, you don't taunt a captor like that if you want to be kept safe, right? He's trying to provoke her into doing something almost. And if he's not trying, then he's certainly, you know, unintentionally really doing a good job of trying to provoke her.
I thought what he was trying to provoke her in is... I think he mentioned it. I don't think it was this episode. I think it was a previous Jamie and Brienne on the road episode where he was trying to provoke her into fighting him in hand-to-hand combat because he thinks he can beat her. So he's like, well, you couldn't beat me. You know, that's what I think, that's the end game he's trying to play with her. He's trying to escape from her. But
once his life is in danger, he's like freaking, gets right in line, you know?
Oh yeah. He's like Team Brienne all the way.
Yeah.
And I think what you saw, you know, when she dispatched them so easily, I think you saw a little bit of respect from Jaime for Brienne, you know?
Yeah.
It's like, well, all right. All right.
And it seemed like she was like inserting the sword, like, up
vertically
into the guy, as opposed, you know, like usually when you kill someone with a sword, you like it's a stabbing motion. Up into. I mean, is it more graphic in the book or?
This scene is. I don't know.
Okay.
I don't know the answer to that because it's actually in the next book, and I haven't reread that one recently. So
I got you.
Sorry,
you.
Guys. Well,
if you know, send us an email at acastofkings@gmail.com.
Yeah, please do send me the corrections about the graphic way in which.
Yeah, I suspect like it's about like the, you know, how she inserted it into him in the book is my guess. And for some reason, I'm just curious to know. That's, I don't know why. I just kind of curious.
This is the perv producer side of Dave. He wants to know about the way in which. This guy was skewered.
Yeah. Let's rewind this episode. There was also this really interesting scene between Roz and Varys.
Did you say really interesting sarcastically?
Well, I say interesting because I'm like, what is going on? You know, what the hell is going on? This scene, it doesn't – it's not – like Varys is like, oh, I see like something in you. Like, no pun intended. Like, I see like – skills, you can help me be a partner in something, right? I mean, like, what is that?
I don't know. Here's my question. Is the actress who plays Roz sleeping with one of the executive producers on the show? What, I mean, no offense to her. She's doing a fantastic job, and she's very beautiful.
Good job completely undercutting, like, 9 hours worth of, you know, advocating for feminism and women's rights, Joanna.
Okay, thank you. Is she somebody's niece? I don't know why she's on the show. I don't know why they keep forcing her character, this totally made up character. I don't understand why they keep forcing her into the narrative. And so obviously, you know, I thought once she had played the role that she played this season, as the, you know, as the substitute for Shay, you know, the bait and switch for Shay, that would be the end of her. But now they've set her up for like a bigger role next season as Varys' co-conspirator. I don't understand why they keep shoehorning her in. I don't get it at all.
Well, I actually, okay, first of all, let me just say, Joanna, I mean, like, the tone that you're taking, which I kind of take issue with, and not in a serious way, just like I take issue in that I disagree with you,
sure.
Is that it sounds like the way you're talking about it sounds like, because it's a completely made-up character, therefore the character has like less validity than a character that, or has less like artistic merit than a character that was in the book. And I categorically disagree that that should be the case. And I think you make it sound that way, and it might be involuntary, but you know that's just the way that you think, at least about this character. Now, I will say like this particular scene was totally baffling to me, but I just
don't understand. Like,
in general, I think I think the show has used her effectively, and I think you disagree because you just, it's not easy for you to accept that a completely made up character could be used well.
That's entirely possible.
But I think until this point, everything has made sense, and I think they've used her well. This scene, it's kind of like when Tony Stark made Pepper Potts the CEO of Stark Industries. It's like, okay, like she had some skills, but really, you know, like type of thing, like. Anyway, sorry, you may say something, though.
No, it's okay. I just disagree in terms of, I think the role she served in the first season was clearly sex position. Like, that's was clearly her role in the first season. And in this season, it's not as clear to me what her role was, but
it I can agree with
that. It seemed clear to me that they kept her around so that she could play the part that she did in the whole Shay gambit. Like, that's why they kept Roz around this season.
Okay,
why
okay.
They would want to keep...
I would argue, Joanna, I think I can make a pretty convincing argument that they kept her around as a kind of way to... Another way to demonstrate how women are brutalized in this culture.
You know, that's interesting that you brought that up, because actually the only line I wrote down from this episode was maybe I didn't write it down. The only line I meant to write down from this episode was when Varys says that Littlefinger sees her as nothing more than some profitable holes. which is just like the most disgusting thing I've ever heard. Not that it was said in the series, but
Then I should modify my pickup lines, Joanna.
yeah, don't use that down at the bars and it won't fly in Seattle.
Okay.
But profitable holes. And you know, to a certain extent, I kind of feel like that's how the show has treated her to a certain extent. If they give her a cooler role next season as like some sort of political intriguer within, you know, with Varys, then okay. You know what, Dave, I hear you and I will try to be more open to the possibility of Roz being a very interesting character going forward.
Yeah, but I basically – what I'm arguing, Joanna, is that you basically had it in for her from the start and I think you're really not giving her a fair shake because I think that – even if you've never read the books like me and you look at what she's done this season, I think it's pretty solid. So with the exception
– I would disagree because I had not read the books when I watched the show last season and I didn't like her character. I didn't like what they were using her for.
Okay.
And
but that's still what I'm saying is this – like there is that scene at the beginning of the season when Littlefinger's just like, dude, got to get back to work, man. The show must go on. And that was like a really chilling scene that still sticks with me till today. And I mean, almost like she's never meant to be a major character. So she's a side character. And you see this really kind of chilling interaction and kind of the way that Joffrey uses her. It's worth it, in my opinion, just to pick this other side of this culture. So okay. I don't want to spend so much time dwelling
for
on
sure.
this
because
she's obviously a minor character.
Right.
But I think that your attitude – I guess I'm spending any time dwelling on it because I'm sure your attitude is not uncommon, that there are a lot of people who read the books and they're like, what the hell is with these deviations? Any deviations can't possibly be as good as
what not – that's not true in terms of – well, for me
for
anyway.
You, for you.
Because,
but I know there are people out there that –
yeah. Well, I will just – yeah. I do just want to defend myself though because like with – as I've mentioned over and over again – with the Arya and Tywin stuff, which is not in the book at all, I've loved it. It's
right.
like one of my favorite parts of the season. So I think there are ways in which the variations – and as I mentioned this episode, The House of the Undying, they did it completely differently, but I thought it was just as good if not better. You know, and so there are ways in which the deviations don't bother me. A character made up out of whole cloth – that is a little interesting.
It's a little too much. It's a little bit.
Yeah,
I get it. I think we're on the same page.
Point being,
none of us get. None of us understand the Varys, like what Varys sees in her. But maybe that will be revealed next season. We'll see. We'll give it a shot.
But it was enjoyable to watch her try to feel for whatever was between his legs and find nothing there.
Yes.
That was a pretty funny moment.
Yeah.
So thank you.
All right, what else happened this episode? Only a couple other things. The Jon Snow storyline.
Right.
Which, you know, again, still didn't make – this is another element where it's very clear that they're trying to drag this out longer than it should be.
Right.
Because we talked about this two episodes ago where Jon Snow kind of has that altercation with the guy. Like, I just don't let me just – you know, Jonah, please explain this to me because I think I just don't get it, okay, is that – why exactly do they trust John now? Because he got in an altercation with Halfhand and in a crime of passion, like kills Halfhand, and now he's trustworthy all of a sudden? That makes no sense to me. Am I missing something? Right? Please explain if I'm missing something.
I don't think you're missing anything from the show. I think the show is missing something from the books.
I see.
But okay. Since we just had that conversation, I feel reluctant to say so. But
okay, then don't say so. But I'm just saying two.
No, but I will say that it's. It's clear. I think it was very confusing. I think a lot of people have been confused by this. A lot of people were confused. Okay, let me make a broader point, which is that you have said over and over again, and I agree, that the television show should be judged independently as a television show.
Yeah.
And, you know, that while it's interesting and worthwhile to think about the way in which it's different from the books, it should be judged on its own as a television show. So what I will say is – it has failed a couple times to adequately explain plot points. I'm not saying that TV should be dumb and obvious, but you know, a lot of people had confusions over what, like, how Stannis got back to, you know, being with Melisandre,
right.
Or why the Hound, you know, that the Hound was afraid of fire wasn't obvious to a lot of people, you know, who hadn't read the books, or what's going on with Corn and Jon and their whole fight and why people, you know, if it's just, not obvious, or if it's not, you know, not just obvious, but if it's not clear, without me, you know, or my proxy explaining what happened in the books, then they're not quite doing their job as storytellers in the TV medium, right?
Then they have failed, yeah. And that's where we get in. That's where I get into the Harry Potter comparison a little bit. I'm not going to go too far into that this time, but it's just like where that series of films like depended so much on your knowledge of the characters in the books, and season one of Game of Thrones did not do that at all, and that's why I loved it so much. And this season seems like it's starting to creep into that, and it really kind of troubles me. So
John killed Corin, and
therefore now you can trust John because he killed Corin because he got in a fight, right? I mean, that's basically all I get from it right now. So
and then they see Mance Rayder's camp, and then there's just thousands of people down there.
Right. So looking forward to that. Whatever's mm-hmm. going on with that, even though I don't really. Then we go, what's happening? And I think the only other storyline that we haven't discussed is the Samwell storyline, where they find the White Walkers, or the White Walker with all these zombie people behind him.
Right.
And they are heading towards – is there a destination they're heading towards that you see, or is it just – like you see them heading towards this cliff. Is it clear what that is?
I know what it is, but I don't know.
Okay, maybe it's possible we are not supposed to know what it is. So I didn't remember what it was, but anyway, they're heading towards
something.
I think
they generally seem to be heading wallward.
Yeah, yeah. So they're heading south then,
right.
Perhaps?
Right. Correct.
Yeah, so.
What did you think of the CGI and the effects of the zombies?
I thought it was solid.
Okay.
It was not, they demanded a lot of the CGI. Like, they were, like, super close-up of the face, and then you have hundreds of, like, zombie people. Well, the hundreds of zombie people, you don't even need any CGI for that. You can just use costumes for that.
Right.
But the super zoom in of the face, I thought it was solid. You know, like, it's not the best CGI I've ever seen, but it wasn't distractingly bad. So.
Okay. The thing is, in the first episode of the first season – they didn't use CGI for the White Walkers.
Well, they used a little bit of CGI, right? Maybe for the eyes?
Right, a little bit for the eyes, but it wasn't like this is some digitally rendered being. It was like obviously a dude in a costume, you know? And personally, I thought that was creepier. But it was quite an impressive and filmic ending to any TV series, you know?
Yeah, and I wonder like kind of what – like I thought Samwell was going to die right there. And that's why he was crying, and I was like experiencing it with him. I was like, "Well, he knows his life is about to be over." But the dude's like, he's like the freaking Borg. Apparently, he's like, "Well, this guy doesn't pose a threat, so let's keep going." I guess it's not clear to me whether Samwell survives. I can't imagine he does, but he's not shown on screen getting killed, right?
Right.
Yeah. So anyway, so to summarize, I guess what I'm saying is, in my opinion, this season finale. Solid sort of wrap-ups. Solid wrap-up for Dany, despite dragging her storyline out. Like, they ended it really satisfyingly and nice. Like, classic sort of season ender with her. Good ending for Tyrion. And I love the Theon work that they did, although I wish they had shown us more. The Jon Snow stuff, the Arya stuff, the Roz Varys stuff, the Jaime Brienne stuff, the Robb stuff. Totally unsatisfying.
The so, Jaime Brienne stuff wasn't totally unsatisfying.
No, you're right. You're right. But I guess what I'm saying is, like, I have no idea where that plot is even going.
Right.
Like, they're trying to return him to King's Landing. I mean, dude, at the pace that they're going, the sort of political dynamics may be completely different by the time they arrive. Robb might already be taken over King's Landing by the time Brienne gets there with Jaime.
Yeah.
You know, like, it's just, you have no idea what's going on there. So... that's what I mean when I say unsatisfying. So
sure. Well, that's just sort of them setting out on the road. I mean, I think you can make that argument about where Arya ended up the end of last season or whatever, you know, just setting out on the road, trying to figure things out.
So I guess I still love this show. I still think it's one of the best shows in television. And the reason I started this podcast is because, I mean, at the end of season one of Game of Thrones, virtually every single character had gone through an arc of some sort. You know what I mean? And I just don't feel the same way about this season. And that's kind of one of the reasons why I think season two is inferior to season one in a lot of ways. But there are a ton of great episodes within season two. There are a lot of great moments, fantastic acting throughout, and of course, one of the finest hours of television probably ever made in history in Blackwater, directed by Neil Marshall last week. So that's kind of my general thoughts on season two. I don't know if you have any thoughts to add to that, Joanna.
I agree. As harsh as we were on the season finale, I look forward to every Sunday that Game of Thrones is on. I think it's really fun. I think you and I just have a lot of fun sort of figuring out the highs and the lows. And sometimes that can come across as not enjoying the show. But you, both of us do. We love the show. And I, for one, am excited for next season.
So, as I mentioned at the beginning of this week's episode, we got a ton of email from people and some really intelligent, well-thought-out emails about what I discussed last week. Go ahead, Joanna.
Well, I just wanted to thank everyone for the responses that we got this week. They were all really, really nice. So thank you. I wanted to say, you know, I come at it from a different perspective, obviously, from Dave, because this is my first, like, officially my podcast. Dave was nice enough to have me as a guest a couple times before this, but this is literally my first podcast, and it's been a hugely positive experience for me. I understand why it's been a negative experience for you, Dave, but for me, it's just been really nice to have this level of discourse with people, with you, and then with people in general, writing in emails, comments, Twitter, etc. It's been really fun for me, a really fun project. I really want to thank you, Dave, for doing it with me, and I want to thank everyone who has been listening. I just have had a blast this season. So
I will say, like, I've been so impressed with a lot of the emails and how it's like when I read some of these emails, I'm like, dude, you should be hosting a podcast because this is so good. You know what I mean? Like, that's how impressed I am. And like a lot of the emails make me feel unworthy of being listened to by the people who are writing in. And then there are, you know, emails that are the complete opposite of that. But, you know, whatever, we don't need to get into that at this point. But the point being, this show would not exist or would not continue to exist without the massive wave of support and engagement that you guys have given us. And so we are both grateful for that. Despite my kind of complaining at times, we are both grateful that we've been able to go through this adventure together. So, now that that's been said, in terms of what we're going to do next season, we're going to try to do it. I would say this is probably how it's going to go down, is we'll see what's going on in our lives at that point when that season comes out. And if there's time in my schedule, if there's time in Joanna's schedule, we're going to do it. Now, I will also say that there is a possibility we may do a Kickstarter to do it, in which case, if we do a Kickstarter, like, there will definitely be no complaining whatsoever from my part about any abuse that I receive. Basically, I just need to be paid, and then I'll be. If you can just like meet my number, then you can abuse me verbally however you wish.
I love this so much. Dave and I have talked about this a little bit, but he neglected earlier to put it in terms of I'm going to ask them to give me money so they can abuse me. So that's my new favorite premise for the podcast next year. Give Dave money so that you can then hurl abuses at him.
Yeah, and then it'll be fun. You know, like, there's a certain amount of money that I like, my reserve price that I need in order to be willing to withstand verbal abuse. And then once that price is met, then I'll have no problem. So how this is going to go is what I would suggest you do is subscribe to the show on iTunes or Zune or wherever via RSS or however you do it. And then I would say, like, 2 to 3 weeks before the next season of Game of Thrones premieres, we're probably going to release an episode explaining what the deal is, right? We'll say, hey, we're going to come back, or hey, we're going to, like, there's a Kickstarter to support us. If you want us to do the Game of Thrones podcast, you just support us by Kickstarter. So watch out, and then it'll just pop up in your feed automatically. So that's how it's going to happen in terms of the future of Game of Thrones. Now, Joanna, some people have also suggested that we do a season one review, like review each episode of season one.
That's true. They have.
I don't know what your thoughts on that were. I think it would be pretty different than this season because we already know I already know what's going to happen in the future. So we almost both be able to speak from a position of privileged knowledge. So I think it would be a different show. It's not something I'm opposed to, but it's something that we'd have to kind of find the time for.
Yeah, that's something we can think about for sure. Let me tell you guys, I mean, whether or not you're interested, I don't know, but I'm going to tell you anyway, which is the way this podcast came around.
I'm not interested, I can already tell you.
I know, you're already sleeping.
I'm already falling asleep, yeah.
The way this podcast came about was Dave was like, hey, Joanne, I want to do something. I'm like, hey, yeah, Dave, I do want to do something. He's like, hey, what should we do? And I said, hey, that Game of Thrones show is pretty neat. And thus a podcast was born.
That's a really good Dave Chen impression, by the way.
Never underestimate our whims. whimsical whims and what we'll do as a result of them.
Yeah, I mean, I believe the first episode of this podcast was released like a day before or the day of the season premiere.
Oh, yeah. I forgot an integral part. Dave was like, sure, I kind of want to do that, except I'm moving across country and uprooting my entire life right around that time. So yeah. I don't know. So, but he did it anyway, guys. So never underestimate Dave's commitment to bring you his informed opinions.
My random ramblings and infuriating opinions, I think, is what you mean to say. and I think we can end it there, Joanna. Where can people find more of your work on the internet this week, Joanna Robinson?
Every day over on pajiba.com. That's PAJIBA.com. Or they can follow me on Twitter at @QuitYourJRob.
You can find me at twitter.com/DaveChensky. That's Dave Chen, S-K-Y. Find my personal blog at DaveChen.net. My other podcast at /filmcast.com and at TobolowskiFiles.com. It has been, despite any protestations, it has been an incredibly cool experience to know that there are people out there listening to us. There are people out there that actually care about what our opinions are about this awesome show. Few things are more rewarding than that. So thank you guys for listening. We'll see you guys later.